January 2nd, 2025. Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am still in 2025, Avi Wolfman Arendt. Happy New Year, CG.
Happy New Year, AWA.
It is lovely to have another year to do this with you.
I know.
I really do feel privileged about that. Any New Year's resolutions that I should know about? Everyone should know about.
Yeah, well, my New Year's resolution, as you can see, I have a metal cup here.
Okay.
And you know, I've been drinking bottled water forever, but I am...
Shame on you.
I know. I have this cup now, you know, with a straw. It's big. And
I thought you were going to do a slurp sound.
I've been converted because the entire Studio 2 family, they have these wonderful stainless steel water containers.
Yeah.
And I've decided to take a step back, look at my carbon footprint, stop throwing away all these bottles, and move on.
Welcome to the revolution.
Thank you.
Cherry Gregg.
And you know how I feel about water for a variety of reasons, but I'm going to step out of my comfort zone and think about the earth.
My resolution, and I like to be aggressive
yes.
with mine, I would love if Studio 2 was able to live broadcast on YouTube.
Oh, would that?
But
would
even
that?
Maybe even as soon as Tuesday. And I know that's really putting that out there. But
you know what? Manifest it.
I'm going to try.
You're going to manifest it?
I'm going to try. no need to manifest the political environment. It's happening. It's mm-hmm. happening all around us. And we know what's coming, right? A second Trump term. We're going to talk about it today on Studio 2 with a couple of political insiders. We'll get their takes on what they think is going to happen over the next 100 days or so. But we want, of course, to get your opinion on today's episode. How are you feeling about the coming Trump term? What do you think he will do in the first days of his presidency? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org.
Yeah, we're already getting a couple of emails and some comments on Facebook, so we look forward to hearing
from you.
People
have thoughts on this. No surprise.
Yeah, and it's Thursday, even though it's our first live show of this week and this year. It is still Thursday, which means...
Which means what?
Oh, the
Studio 2 DJ of the day?
I don't know. I know.
I saw it pop up on our screen.
I probably said that too.
Yeah, no, it's weird to do it today. It doesn't feel like a Thursday. Yeah. I woke up and I thought it was Monday. But yeah, it is Thursday. And so we'll have our Studio 2 DJ of the day. We always close the week with a song picked by a listener. And today we're asking just, I don't know, we're trying to keep it loose. What's a song that's like bringing you into the new year, a song that you're definitely going to be listening to in 2025 that maybe we should listen to as well. So email us, studio2@whyy.org. Producer Paige will pick her favorite. You got to get in by 12:30, by the way. And then we'll play it at the end of the show and we'll shout you out. So Studio 2 DJ of the Day is on the docket as well, studio2@whyy.org. We also have three local news stories to get to, Cherry. And we're going to start off with the story that everyone has been talking about over the last 48 hours or so.
Yeah, as you heard on Wednesday morning, New Year's Day, a man rammed a truck into a crowd on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, killing at least 15 people and injuring dozens of others. The man has been identified as Texas native and U.S.-born Army veteran Shamsuddin Jabbar. He was shot and killed after opening fire on law enforcement, and the investigation into his motives and just exactly what happened is still ongoing. But there are some local connections. Two of the victims of this attack are from or have connections to our area. One of the murdered victims is a former Princeton football player named Martin Tiger Besh. Besh attended high school in Louisiana and became an all-Ivy kick returner at Princeton. He played three seasons from 2016 to 2018. And Princeton's football coach, the head of the football there, Bob Cerace, said in a statement of Tiger Besh, quote, "He was a tiger in every way, a ferocious competitor with endless energy, a beloved teammate, and a caring friend." And he sent out his love to the entire Besh family. Also among the injured, Ryan Quigley from Lansdale, Montgomery County, who graduated from Lansdale Catholic High School in 2016 and attended Princeton University in 2020. My heart goes out to all the victims and just everybody who was there on, you know, early morning, New Year's Day. What a terrifying experience that must have been.
Yeah, I'm into that. Just an extra sort of heartfelt extension to the entire Princeton community.
Yes.
We'll be thinking about you today and in the weeks ahead. Our second story today that caught our eye, this is something that kind of tickles me personally. So 50 years ago, the Philadelphia Daily News ran a whole section about their 50th anniversary. So they turned 50 years ago in 1975.
Wow.
And in this special episode of the Daily News, they had people predict what would happen in 50 years into the future.
Which is now,
2025.
Mm.
And so they got all these prominent people to get together and prognosticate about the year 2025. And the prognostications are A, entertaining, and B, for the most part, highly inaccurate. I will share a couple. I will share a couple with you. So,
I don't know why I thought you were going to say they were spot on or something. But
oh yeah, they were all Nostradamus in 1975.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely not. Yeah.
No. It is actually a nice reminder, though, that all the problems that you obsess about today and that you project into the future either resolve themselves or sort of fade into the background, because like a lot of people were obsessed with population growth, overpopulation. That problem has become far less severe over the last 50 years, for example. But among the predictions, Ed Bacon, who was a famous city planner here in Philadelphia, said that basically there would be no private cars in Philadelphia, that the air would be a far cleaner, and that there would be no gangs. He was sort of 0 for 3 on that one.
And no private cars.
One of my favorite was from a guy named Mo Septi, who was associated with the Live Arts, and he predicted that we would have 5-hour work days by the year 2025.
Wow.
Do you work 5 hours a day?
I wish, no.
Yeah. but part of his prediction was that because people would work 5 hours a day, they would have lots of time for leisure, and therefore the performing arts would be ascendant. I don't know if that is exactly played out, but nice try, Mo. John Facenda, do you know the name John Facenda? Does that mean anything to you?
It rings a bell, but
he was a great broadcaster, especially sports broadcaster, from that era and a little bit before. And he predicted, and I wish this had turned out to be true, that radio signals would be transmitted directly into people's brains.
Wow!
By the year 2025. In a way, that's close, right? Because, like, you have Bluetooth.
Earbuds.
Like, it's closer than you would think, but it's still kind of a funny prediction. And there's a lot more. So the Daily News did, or the Inquirer.com did run a little, like, roundup of all the predictions. And it's pretty entertaining. It's worth checking out.
I will mention one that kind of came true, but not really.
Okay.
It was the garbage would be collected up to 4 times a week.
Yes.
And we now have this pilot where
we got halfway there.
Two
in like one small section of the city. So yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. But some of the doomsday predictions also did not turn out to be true. Like Buckminster Fuller, who's a famous architect, like basically said the earth would be not inhabitable unless we got rid of like a long laundry list of endemic issues. And the bad news is that we did not get rid of the issues. The good news is that Earth is, for the moment, still habitable. So so he was off there. Do you have any 2075 predictions you'd like to share right now?
Not really. what I realize in reading this story is that things take a lot longer than you might think.
Yeah.
Fifty years is not a long time.
Seems like a long horizon.
Yeah, they thought
here.
We would be in space by now. We're not.
Yeah.
So
like
living
in space.
Yeah,
we are in space.
Yeah, but I mean like they thought we would have, you know, whole colonies and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
That
totally.
Didn't happen.
Totally.
So third story for today.
This you don't have to wait 50 years for this.
No. For our Abbott Elementary fans, full disclosure, I am one. Mm-hmm. And for people who are fans of It's Always Sunny in Philly. There's a treat. These two fictional Philadelphia worlds will collide in a crossover episode.
When's it going to be?
Well, January 8th. And
aren't you glad I asked?
Yeah. Aren't you glad? And so here's the premise of it. It's Always Sunny. The gang from that show will be at Abbott Elementary to help out.
Yeah.
You know, volunteers of some sort. There was some flirtation between Principal Ava, who already has this type of reputation, and Rob McElhenney's character. And I think I just messed his name
up. No, you got it.
I got it. And so the sizzle video made me laugh. So I know it's going to be good. And I think we have a little bit of a clip. So take a look.
Oh, yeah. Let's sizzle.
Yeah.
Welcome to Abbott Elementary, the best elementary school in the universe. Is that what this is?
It takes two to make things go right.
Let me know if there's anything you need. And I mean anything.
Did it.
You're trash, you know that?
Coming from the sheriff of trash.
The dialogue, the looks, the side eyes. It just makes the show so good.
Just to be clear, it's an episode of Abbott in which the It's Always Sunny people show up.
They
more crossed over into them.
That's a power play by Abbott Elementary to volunteer.
Yeah, so it's in the cadence. It's that show. But
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, this is a great moment for Philadelphia television. It's maybe the pinnacle.
the pinnacle.
Maybe the pinnacle of Philadelphia television. It did get me thinking about other potential Philadelphia crossovers. And I thought, what if there was a remake of The Sixth Sense?
Yeah, that's movie crossovers right there. Bring some folks back, yeah.
Rocky characters are the ghosts.
Oh, goodness.
Would that work?
I don't know. Like, you know, I love Sixth Sense, and I don't know if Rocky would be in it. But I feel like...
Okay, how about Rocky and Silver Linings Playbook?
That might work.
Could that cross over?
That might work better, yeah.
All right, call me up, Universal Studios.
That might work a lot better. But there's some... I mean, Philly is in so many movies. And so there's a lot of potential crossover there. I mean, you can bring all kinds of things here.
The Philadelphia Story. Oh, hey, there's the... they're playing us off. With a little music from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
I love that.
So, yeah, we'll be watching for that on the 8th. We're also watching for... the next administration, what they're going to do in Trump round two. And what do you think will be the likely outcomes of the first days and weeks of the second Trump presidency? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. We also have our Studio 2 DJ of the day.
Don't forget to get those in by 1230.
Also studio2@whyy.org. One email inbox, two tasks, and we'll be back on the other side of this quick break. And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. On January 20th, Inauguration Day, Donald Trump returned to the Oval Office. The transition is in its final stretch. They're trying to rally support for cabinet nominations, iron out policy positions, and much more. And while many people are bracing for a second Trump term, how much of round two will resemble his first?
We can read a lot into what his administration's agenda will be based on cabinet picks so far and campaign promises on deportations, tax breaks, and tariffs. With a new Congress opening tomorrow and Trump headed toward the White House, we're spending today previewing the political days ahead. What tops Trump's to-do list? Will his most controversial cabinet picks, Pete Hegseth, Kash Patel, RFK Jr., Tulsi Gabbard, will they all get confirmed? And how will the Democrats work with the new White House, or perhaps against it? With us are two longtime D.C. observers. Molly Ball is the senior political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Molly, welcome into Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. And Sahil Kapoor is the senior political correspondent for NBC News. Sahil, welcome to Studio 2.
Great to join you.
Our question for you, our listeners today, is how are you feeling about the new Trump administration? What do you think he's likely to do in the first days and weeks of his presidency? Give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. So, Molly and Sahil, I wanted to start this conversation talking about Congress because the new Congress begins tomorrow. It'll kick off on the heels of a major controversy where billionaire Elon Musk nearly derailed a carefully crafted deal between Speaker Mike Johnson and Democrats to pass the budget and avoid government shutdown. None of that happened, right? It was able to go through, but now they'll have a 5-member advantage. I want you to each kind of lay out the challenges you see in this new Congress and the opportunities that exist. And Molly, we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, on the one hand, so that shutdown fight a couple of weeks ago was in some ways a good preview of what is coming, and in some ways not. It was the prior Congress, not the Congress that's coming to town tomorrow. But it is similar in the sense that, as you say, House Speaker Mike Johnson has a very, very small majority to work with. He needs 218 votes to be elected speaker tomorrow. There are 219 Republicans, and one of them has already said he's not going to vote for Speaker Johnson. And many others have said they are undecided or have questions about his leadership. I think we all remember a couple of years ago when Kevin McCarthy spent several days in, you know, this humiliating spectacle of multiple speaker votes before he got the job the first time. And then, of course, a few months later, he lost the job due to a similar dynamic playing out. It's just the fact of those thin margins. It's actually not that, you know, Mike Johnson is any less popular with Republicans than prior speakers. But if you think back to when Trump became president the first time in 2017, then House Speaker Paul Ryan could lose 23 Republican votes and wow, still become speaker. Mike Johnson can lose one. So again, it's not really the case that the Republican Party is any more divided. It's just that they need so much more near unanimity in order to get anything done. And that is going to be the dynamic in the coming months and years as well, as they try to get Trump's agenda through Congress or for that matter, simply keep the lights on, which was such a challenge a few weeks ago. It's just going to be very, very difficult to keep everyone in the tent, even though they all profess loyalty to Donald Trump and his agenda. Anything that Trump wants to get through Congress is going to run into this same difficult dynamic of these very narrow margins. And that also gives Democrats potentially some leverage.
And Sahil, your thoughts on this?
I do think last month was a little taste of the legislative chaos that we're going to see throughout this year. And there is a lot on Congress's plate. First, they have to elect a speaker tomorrow. Maybe they'll do it. Maybe they won't. I think the big advantage that Mike Johnson has is that there's no alternative. You can't beat something with nothing. And what Republicans really don't want is to go through another 3 weeks without a speaker like they did with Kevin McCarthy. That resets the whole playing field right as they want to get moving on Trump's agenda. So it'll be challenging for Mike Johnson, but he might still pull through. But remember, getting elected speaker is the easy part for Johnson. He's got to fund the government again by March 14th. There's a new deadline there. He's going to need Democratic votes to do that. He's got to deal with a debt limit extension at some point in the middle of the year, and Republicans absolutely hate dealing with that issue. And he's got to juggle those things with major, massive party line bills that Donald Trump wants to pursue on immigration, border security, on taxes, on energy. Some of this stuff is going to have to get through this parliamentary maneuver called reconciliation in the Senate, where you can bypass the 60-vote threshold. But right now in the House, I think that's where the action is going to be. It's a one-vote margin because Matt Gaetz is not going to take his seat. So it's 219 to 215. If they lose two votes, that's a 217 to 217 tie, which means the pending business bill or whatever it is fails on the floor. And once they get that seat back, which is going to be a few months from now, it will be 215 to 220 to 215, which means they can spare two votes. Wow. So that's the reality that Mike Johnson is looking at for all of these, for all of these ambitions. He is about to have a very exciting year ahead.
Who do you see, Sahil, as the chaos agents here within the House? Is it a moderate Republican or two? Is it a far right Republican or two? Like, if someone's going to derail a piece of legislation, who is the likely culprit?
In the House Republican caucus, the chaos always comes from the right. The exact opposite is true in the Democratic caucus. It's usually the centrists who make the most trouble, who pressure leadership the most. But in the Republican conference, it's always the right-wing members who exert leverage, who use their votes, who withhold votes to demand They get their way. So a few names come to mind. The first is, of course, Tom Massie. He is claiming the one hall pass that the conference has on the Johnson speaker vote. He's impervious to pressure on this. He does not care that Donald Trump is threatening primary challenges and that Elon Musk, who's worth more than $400 billion, is threatening to, use his own money to take out members who don't follow Trump's agenda. He doesn't care about any of that. Another one to watch is Congressman Chip Roy of Texas. He's a true believer. He's a fiscal conservative. He's a hardliner. He endorsed Ron DeSantis for president, so he's no Trump fan. He's not really a MAGA guy, and he believes in things like red ink and free trade and fiscal conservatism, things that Donald Trump doesn't really care much about when when push comes to shove. So I would watch those two. And then the third would be Andy Harris, who's the chair of the Freedom Caucus. There are several dozen votes there. Does he lead them and kind of encourage them to use their votes in a block to pressure Trump to certain places? Because he will have a lot of leverage, and that caucus will have a lot of leverage if they use it. Or will he become basically a Trump ally and use his power to try to corral votes for Trump when he tries to move in a certain direction?
Tom Massie from Kentucky, I believe, right, Sahil?
Correct.
And he strikes me, and I don't know his full biography, as something of a libertarian figure. So is the idea here, Molly Ball, that the libertarians pose the biggest threat to order within the Republican caucus, the folks who, as Sahil mentioned, are true believers in free trade, in some of these old school limited government principles that don't really fit into the box of Trumpism? Do you see, like, if you're looking at ideological factions, is that the one that poses the biggest threat, Molly Ball?
It is the ideological right. I would not necessarily call them libertarians. Massey is really, if not one of a kind, pretty unique in this regard, in calling himself a libertarian and extending that to things like, civil liberties and national security. But when it comes to fiscal conservatism and taking a hard line on spending, there are a lot of Republicans who are much more in the old school conservative camp than they are on Trump's side. Remember, Trump, blew up the deficit during his first presidency, has never been someone who really cared about reducing the size of government. And that was really the crux of the conflict a couple of weeks ago. There was this handshake agreement made that before they raise the debt limit, they'll find $2 trillion, $2.5 trillion of spending to cut. But nobody believes that could really happen because it would be massively disruptive and would go against a lot of the things that Trump has promised, such as preserving Social Security and Medicare. Yes, it is the ideological right, and it is Republicans who believe in small government. It's not necessarily libertarians per se, but that is just a fundamental philosophical disagreement between Trump and what we used to consider the Republican Party. And this was a problem, during Trump's first term as well, that there were a lot of Republicans who still believed in small government, despite the fact that Trump was not as concerned with it.
By the way, about that agreement that Molly just mentioned, to find 2 trillion in cuts, I spoke a few days before, actually just as they were walking off the floor on the last day of session in December, to Congressman Tim Burchett, who said that's a gentleman's agreement and there are no gentlemen up here.
Wow. Well said.
I tell you, Congress, it's going to be so interesting this next administration. And our question of the day for our listeners is, how are you feeling about the new Trump administration? What do you think Trump's likely to do in the first days and weeks of his presidency? You can call us. The number's 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. We have several callers on the line, so I want to bring one of them in. We have Jason from Philadelphia on the line. Jason, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I'm just concerned about the growing Christo-fascist movement that Trump is standing kind of behind, and then also the oligarchy position with aligning himself and his cabinet with a bunch of billionaires. So that's really deeply concerning to me, and I don't think he's going to really work for the American people at all.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's Jason from Philadelphia, and that sort of is a perfect transition to the next part of our conversation. Molly and Sahil, the question I have for you, we're going to go through some of these cabinet picks, and we just heard from our caller, like, there's a number of very rich people and wealthy people who are going to possibly be on this cabinet, a number of others who are going to be advising him. And so I want to kind of take some time and talk about some of the more controversial picks. And one of the most controversial, which we teased during our show, is the pick for Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, a Fox News host, former Army veteran who was in combat twice. I want to get your thoughts on this. And Sahil, we'll start with you. I mean, he is has been a very controversial pick. Folks didn't even think he would get confirmed. Things have sort of shifted in recent weeks. Could he make it through? And what will be his biggest challenges?
He could make it through. Things definitely have shifted after Matt Gaetz, the original attorney general nominee, went down. Trump just basically took the L on that and withdrew that nomination and moved on after it became clear privately to him that Gaetz didn't have the votes. But Pete Hegseth is the nominee that Trump decided and his allies decided to make a stand on, fearing that if another nominee can be taken down, then it's open season on all of his nominations. So that's where the threats came in. That's where the pressure campaign came in, the phone calls, the online posts by Elon Musk saying anyone who doesn't support Trump's agenda will be primaried. And again, he has a lot of money to carry out that threat if he chooses to. So that's where, you know, certain senators like Joni Ernst of Iowa, who are on the fence, she sits on the committee that will oversee his nomination. She's mm-hmm. a female combat veteran who is going to have to vote on a Secretary of Defense nominee who said he doesn't believe women should serve in combat. That is not going to go over well at the hearing. It's also not going to go over well that Hegseth is going to be sitting across from Senator Tammy Duckworth, who lost her legs in combat fighting for this country. So the hearing is going to matter a lot for Pete Hegseth. I think he is on course right now. If everything goes well for him from here, I think he's on course to be confirmed. But if he slips up in his hearing, if he has some bad moments that end up rallying opposition to him, I think there's still a question mark there. And then, of course, the FBI background check for Pete Hegseth. Last thing I want to note, guys, is to the point about what your caller just mentioned, the oligarchy question. Mm-hmm. I would expect Democrats to pick up on this and use this as a line of attack. They need an mm-hmm. economic populist message, and they see this as a very good one, that Trump is now enlisting people like Elon Musk, unelected mm-hmm. billionaires, as they keep saying it, to help run the White House.
Molly Ball, let me talk to you about nominees and who you think is maybe least likely to get through, and perhaps all of them do get through. But we got Tulsi Gabbard, RFK Jr., mm-hmm. Kash Patel, FBI. I mean, when you look at this, the group of nominees who've drawn the most questions and pushback, is there one or two that you think will suffer the same fate as Matt Gaetz, mm-hmm. or is it going to be clear sailing from here?
I would say neither. I expect them all to get hearings, but I don't know that that necessarily means they're all going to get through. Mm-hmm. When I spoke to the new Senate Majority Leader, John Thune, about this a couple weeks ago, that was essentially what he said. He acknowledged that some of these nominees present challenges for various reasons, and he said his commitment is to give them all a fair hearing, a fair process. The Republican senators all consider themselves loyal members of the team, and they all want to help President-elect Trump, and they want to see him succeed in implementing his agenda. But they do have qualms about the nominees that you mentioned. For the most part, are the ones that they have qualms about. And so I think the hearings are going to matter a lot. And the questions that are asked, again, particularly by the Republican senators, and whether these nominees are able to answer them satisfactorily. When it comes to someone like Hegseth, most of the attention has been on allegations of misconduct in his past. I think he's also going to get a lot of questions about his qualifications and his intentions in terms of leading the department.
Yeah.
And the same thing with, a Tulsi Gabbard or an RFK Jr. These people were Democrats until recently. And so I think a lot of Republicans want to hear from them about the policies that they will prioritize and how they plan to lead these executive agencies, and whether that, passes various conservative litmus tests, given that these are not necessarily conservatives who are being put in these positions. So unless something unforeseen happens, I do think they will all get to a hearing. I don't think we will see any more withdrawals of the sort that happened with Gaetz, barring, further revelations. But then those hearings and the votes on those nominees are going to matter a lot.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller. We have Linda from Mount Laurel who's on the line. Linda, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. My concern is that the very rich are in the administration, a bunch of crazy, very rich people, were well off. And Kash Patel is an absolute no way. It's just going to start the political vengeance campaign that Trump wants to do, and or fire everyone in the Justice Department, FBI, CIA. That's what they're trying to do. Mm. Dismantle everything and then just bring in their people so that they can reap vengeance.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's Linda from Mount Laurel. And can we, I think Linda poses this question, and you mentioned this, Molly, about Cash Patel, FBI. Let's talk about this pick. This is the person that Trump is selecting to direct the FBI, has little experience with this agency, which has tens of thousands of folks working there. Your thoughts on this? I mean, this is not the only cabinet pick that has very little experience working in government, working with the bureaucracy. Can you talk about the query that is going to take place for him and some of the others who may not have the typical experience of someone who would be in the nomination seat?
Well, when it comes to Cash Patel, I think it's important to remember that the FBI is a part of the Department of Justice. And so before Cash Patel comes up for confirmation, I think Trump's Attorney General nominee, Pam Bondi, is going to get a lot of questions about how she plans, how she views the FBI and its mandate in light of, the recent potential terror attacks that have just occurred. I think there's going to be a lot of focus on the FBI's ability to investigate, pursue, and prevent terror attacks from occurring, and whether it has been appropriately focused on that prospect. I think Trump campaigned on dismantling the Department of Justice, eliminating its traditional independence from the president, and turning it into an instrument of his will. He believes he has a mandate to do that. He believes that his win in the election proves that the American people agree with him that the FBI has been too focused on, the weaponization of government and witch hunts against Donald Trump and conservatives.
Let me ask you, Molly?
Just to the caller's point, whether people actually are on board with that as it begins to play out is a different question.
Right.
Go on.
But even before we get there, when we're talking about the nomination process, do you think there's among the Republican senators, is there more sort of pushback along ideological lines, or is there more pushback along the lines of we don't want Trump to become too powerful or to remake the bureaucracy in his image? Like, what offends or worries them more? Because it seems like for Patel, it would have to be the latter for him to not get through, right?
Yeah, again, we're going to learn a lot about that over the course of the next few weeks from the hearings and the reporting that gets done. I don't think we know yet. In the past, Republicans have been on board with Trump's opposition to the DOJ and its activities. Republicans have generally not been particularly fazed by his threats in this regard. I think we'll see what kind of questions that someone like Cash Patel gets when he comes up for confirmation, and what amount of concern there is about that. But in the past, Republicans have largely been willing to go along with what critics would term abuses of power by President Trump, where they've mostly resisted him has been more on policy grounds.
And Sahil, I want to bring you back into the conversation and sort of talk about Pam Bondi, the nomination for the Attorney General's office. And we're about to go to a break, and so this is a pretty tight turnaround. But your thoughts on the importance of her in this administration sort of executing the many promises that have been made?
So on Pam Bondi and Cash Patel and all these justice nominees, one of the big questions that they will get asked is whether they intend to carry out Donald Trump's retribution agenda. He's been back and forth on this in the campaign. He ran pretty explicitly on pursuing retribution against those he believes have wronged him in the past. But after he got elected, he told my NBC colleague, Kristen Welker, that he's not going to pursue retribution or go back to the past, that his retribution will be through success. Those are Trump's words. So how do these nominees see it? What promises are they going to make to the Senate in terms of whether they're going to look back into the past or whether they're going to try to look forward? And look, beyond that, I think the issues that senators have with nominees are a mix of scandal, qualifications, and ideology. With Hegseth, it's scandal. There's a lot in his past that's come out that senators find problematic that he will struggle to deal with. On other nominees like Tulsi Gabbard and RFK, it is ideology. Her views on Syria and foreign policy are problematic. With RFK, his support for abortion rights in the past is problematic.
And we'll be right back. Yeah.
It's always a blend. It's always a mix. And we're mixing it up with you, our callers, this hour. Keep those calls coming. 888-477-9499. On the other side of this break, we'll talk about things Trump could do without Congress. That's ahead on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. With President-elect Trump returning to the White House in a couple weeks, we're looking at the transition, the policies he may roll out in his first 100 days or so, and his cabinet picks.
And with us to talk about the Trump presidency and the new Congress are Molly Ball, senior political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Sahil Kapoor, senior national political reporter for NBC News.
Our question for you, our listeners, how are you feeling about the new Trump administration? And what do you think he's likely to do in the first days and weeks of his presidency? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org.
And speaking of our listeners, I want to bring in one of our listeners and callers, Rob from Northern Chester County. Rob, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, first, good afternoon and happy new year, I hope.
Same to you, Rob. Same
yes.
To you.
In addition to all of the above good comments from listeners and your guests, let me reframe the comment I had as a question. Given that we're talking about the first 100 days, will the new Trump administration have the authority to either delay or maybe worse, try to withhold, claw back, rescind without Congress's aid the many good programs that the Biden-Harris administration have been able to get through in the past 4 years?
Yeah.
Interesting question.
Yeah.
Sahil, did you understand Rob's question? Any response? I think he's talking about the ability for the Trump administration to kind of early on, maybe even with going around the chaos of Congress, start to roll things back that the Biden administration put in place.
Yes, I did understand it, and luckily I wrote a piece about this just a few weeks ago. There are certain things that outgoing President Biden did with the stroke of a pen that Trump can very easily undo with the stroke of a pen. So that's executive actions on things like abortion access, birth control, protecting LGBTQ rights, anything related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Trump is very, very likely to undo. Immigration is going to be a singular focus, I think, for the new administration. And there's a lot that the courts have allowed presidents to do by executive action on immigration. Trump is going to take a very, very different tack than Joe Biden on immigration, especially with Congress all jammed up. Republicans are likely to give him money to enforce, to crack down on border security and to try to execute his mass deportation agenda. Then there are other things that Joe Biden got through Congress, which Trump will have to get through Congress in order to undo. The things that Biden did with, on a party line basis are probably the most at risk in this category. The Inflation Reduction Act is the most notable one. Major clean energy programs, rebates for buying, electric vehicles, for, clean energy items in the home. Those are the things that Republicans are planning to put on the chopping block to try to pay for an extension of Trump's tax cuts. They're going to need to get them through Congress. And then finally, there are other things that Joe Biden did on a bipartisan basis, things like the infrastructure law, the CHIPS and Science Act. Republicans are not going to be able to undo those because many of them like those laws. They voted for them. And this, again, here is a reminder that in order for a legacy to stand the test of time, it helps to have a lot of public support and a lot of votes in Congress.
Yeah, I want to kind of continue that line of questioning because there were so many items, and this is our caller asked about the rollback, but there were so many items that, Donald Trump said, this is what I'm going to do on day one. So I want to kind of talk about some of those. He said he's going to settle the Russia-Ukraine war. He's going to close the border and begin the largest deportation operation in American history. Molly, I want you to kind of go over some of these day ones. What can he actually really get done on day one?
A lot of things he can. And we expect the administration to unveil a large suite of executive orders that he will sign on day one. This is traditional for presidents to do. Some of them will be rescinding a lot of the executive orders that Joe Biden put in place. The big picture here is that, you know, as Congress has become more and more gridlocked and ineffective, presidents have seized more and more authority to run the government over the years. And so there's a lot that he can do by executive order, particularly on immigration. He doesn't need a new law to start deporting people who are in the country illegally. However, he may need, you know, personnel and money. That's going to have to come from Congress. Tariffs, he can pretty much impose unilaterally with a few legal asterisks on that. He said he wants to use those tariffs as a source of revenue for programs that would have to go through Congress as well. But I would expect that, you know, on foreign policy, on trade policy, on immigration policy, he is going to start working on those with executive orders right out of the gate. And then things like, you know, changing the orientation of the Justice Department or other policies that he can pursue mainly through executive agencies, those also will not require any kind of congressional involvement beyond confirming the nominees involved. So I think he'll also get started with some of that stuff on the first day. You know, he's promised so many things, and Trump, this is his sort of political style. He tends to promise literally everything so that people on different sides of different issues feel like they've heard what they wanted to hear, and they ignore the fact that he's also said the opposite thing to a different audience.
Right.
So it's very hard to know, you know, is he serious about buying Greenland, or was he just trolling in the middle of the night?
Exactly.
Right?
I was just going to ask you about that, Molly Ball, because when we look at some of maybe the words outlandish, ambitious, out of the ordinary things that he has typed or said, you talked about Greenland. Panama Canal has been out there, ending birthright citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at that sort of collection.
Canada, the 51st state.
Yeah, exactly. Canada, the 51st state. When you look at sort of that general type of proclamation, is there anything in there that you think actually has a chance to be done? Or is there one that you pick out and you say, well, if he had the right allies in place, maybe?
I think he's serious about wanting to do all of these things.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he can get all of them done or is very serious about trying to pursue them. What I think we all learned from covering the first Trump administration is that what he says matters, but what he does is what you really have to watch. And so we're all going to be watching, you know, what executive orders does he actually sign on day one? He said he's going to pardon the, you know, January 6th rioters, but he said conflicting things about whether he's going to pardon all of them, whether it's going to be a blanket pardon, whether it's just going to be here and there, or some of the ones that he feels were, you know, most egregious or the least violent. So again, what does he do on day one in that regard? It's going to tell us a lot about how serious he is about these various different conflicting promises. So
yeah.
I think we've all learned that we have to take Trump seriously, even when something sounds outlandish. There are actually concrete policy and geopolitical reasons that America could benefit from ownership of Greenland, for example. And this is something that people are talking about as not just a joke. But again, watch what he does, see how seriously he decides to pursue it and how much he makes it a priority.
Yeah.
And our question for you, our listeners, of course, is how are you feeling about the new Trump administration? What do you think he's likely to do in the first days and weeks of his presidency? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. I want to read a couple comments. Edie comments, create chaos, seek retribution, lie, rinse and repeat. That's what she thinks the Trump President-elect Trump will do in his first days and weeks. We have an email from Judy who says Trump will release January Sixers from prison and do everything that Putin wants him to do that will weaken our country financially, environmentally, internationally, and begin to eliminate helpful social programs. Those are some thoughts from our listeners. And my question for you, Sahil, I go back to the attorney general pick, Pam Bondi, because I remember from 2016, the lawsuits. And so, you know, a separate from retribution, separate from that agenda, I remember day one, there was the ban on Muslim travel, the Muslim travel ban that happened. And the first thing that happened was lawsuits followed. So how important is this attorney general just in, you know, keeping, making sure that these executive orders remain in place and can be implemented and can be rolled out? And how will she play a role in sort of like moving things forward?
Well, a couple of things. I do think Trump is going to install in senior positions loyalists who will use the levers of power to try to carry out and defend his agenda. There's no doubt about that. That's the attorney general, but also the solicitor general. But that fight is going to play out in the courts that Donald Trump does not directly control. So, yes, he can have his administration try to defend his actions. Basically, anything any president does these days on immigration always gets challenged. So there will be legal challenges if he tries to escalate, you know, his own unilateral immigration policy to a certain place. But just installing, you know, the types of people he installs in his administration is not going to determine whether or not that agenda succeeds. In terms of other things like the territorial expansion stuff, I think this is more than just, you know, him making conflicting promises. This would go so dramatically against everything he's talked about, you know, wanting to be an anti-war president, about wanting to spend less money on foreign conflict, isolation. All these elements of like the growing elements of the MAGA base and the MAGA movement are very much against doing things abroad.
Sure.
So this does strike me as something that, at least I would put this in the trolling category, unless Trump actually takes steps to, you know, to go that route, which we haven't seen.
On that point, because we haven't talked a ton about international relations, Michaud emails, "I'm most worried about Trump weakening Ukraine's bargaining position in any potential ceasefire by withholding or threatening to withdraw military support. I have relatives in Ukraine and fear for their safety and for the rights of Ukrainians for self-determination." And a caller, Keith from Princeton, also wanted to talk about foreign policy. Keith, you're on Studio 2. We're getting toward the end of the hour, but what's your question or comment?
Yeah, that situation in Ukraine. That's I'm a retired Marine officer. That situation on the ground is deteriorating much faster than most people realize. As far as there's no incentive for Putin to come to the negotiation table if funding is cut off. So I'm wondering what the panel thinks as far as what Trump's going to do if Ukraine falls, the two provinces, the most up to the Dnieper River, if they completely fall before, you know, the summertime, what's likely to be Trump's response?
Interesting question from Keith in Princeton. Sahil, Molly, I'll put that to both of you. What's your sense of how Trump will try to maneuver when it comes to Russia, Ukraine?
I think this is a big, big question of the next 6 months to a year. The first is, as the caller just pointed out, the question of another aid package going through Congress when Republicans control both levers and Donald Trump is in the White House, very, very, very questionable. Yeah, I don't know if that's going to continue. The second thing is there have been signals from, you know, high up in the Trump orbit that Trump is on this page of these Russia and Ukraine should cut a deal. And I've talked to Vice President-elect J.D. Vance about this. He thinks Ukraine is going to have to cede some land in order to end the war and do it peacefully. Now, whether they've thought about how that would actually work, whether they understand where the two parties are and what role the U.S. can play in brokering a deal, I've not seen any evidence of that. But suffice it to say that the status quo, where the U.S. is, you know, putting a lot of muscle and a lot of money and weapons to defend or to help Ukraine defend itself, because President Biden and there's a bipartisan majority in Congress that has seen it as essential to U.S. security and protecting NATO and whatnot, that is not going to continue. What form it takes, TBD.
Molly, any thoughts on that?
No, I completely agree with Sahil, and I think it's going to be very closely watched, and it's going to come up in the confirmation hearings for Trump's nominees as well. I think particularly for Secretary of State nominee Marco Rubio, who's broadly popular with the Republicans who will be voting to confirm him, while the senators of both parties, he's likely to get some Democrat votes as well. But I think this is something that a lot of people are going to want to hear him talk about, given that he has in the past been a more sort of establishment-oriented traditional Republican on national security, but then he turned around and voted against the last tranche of aid to Ukraine and has sounded a little bit more America first in recent years as he's sort of gotten on the same page as Trump. So this is another source of ideological tension and conflict among Republicans. Remember, one of the reasons that Mike Johnson is unpopular with many House Republicans is because he moved heaven and earth to get that last
And Molly and Sahil, we're about to wrap up. And so I wanted to wedge this question in. I mean, Republicans now have the power in both chambers. They have the White House. But I wanted to ask you as we wrap up, are they united enough to really govern and get all this done in the next couple of years? Because that's the next big congressional election in 2026. Your thoughts as we wrap up. And if you could keep it to like less than 30 seconds, that would be great.
I mean, the short answer is no, just because the margins are so small that they have to be, again, virtually unanimous. The bigger answer is they do really, really, really want to get some things done. It's going to be hard. They're not going to get everything done that they want to, but I would expect them to get some things through.
Yeah, Sahil?
Right now, they can't even agree on a strategy for how to move the president-elect ambition. So are they going to do one big party line bill? Are they going to do two? They're openly fighting amongst themselves about the process here. Some of them want to go a big bill with just an immigration on the front end, claim a victory there, and then move to taxes later, where the chairman of the House of the Tax Committee, Jason Smith, is pleading with other Republicans saying, if you delay taxes to later, I may not be able to get the votes, and we might get a massive tax increase at the end of this year when the Trump tax cuts expire. So it's a mess. I do not think this group of Republicans is well positioned to govern with the small margins that they have.
And that's where we will leave it with that prediction by Sahil Kapoor, senior national reporter for NBC News. Thank you so much for your time as well as yours, Molly Ball, senior political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to you both.
Yeah. Thank you.
And that music is from our DJ of the day, Julie.
Julie!
Her pick is Good Luck, Babe by Chappelle Roan.
Chapel Roan,
Chapel
Cherry.
Roan.
You have
look,
to know that in 2025.
I didn't know that.
You
I'm
have
like,
to know that in 2025.
Look, I don't know Chapel Roan. I feel bad. Thank you for the correction.
That's a great pick, by the way. Good Luck, Babe. Let's hear a little bit.
And that's a good song, too. I feel
Great.
Bad about
Thank
that.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you also to the folks who produced Studio 2, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Diana Martinez and Tina Calliquet engineer today's show, our executive producer, Kevin McCrory. I'm Avi.
I'm Cherry.
Talk to you soon.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.